Good morning, everyone. I'm Peter. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Amen.
Grateful to be alive and sober and at a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, thank Danny and the committee and all you guys for having Myers and I here this weekend to share our experience, strength, and hope. When I get to do these things, I found out that very simply, your spirit has extended an invitation to mine. And when those things happen, we suit up and show up, and we commence shoulder to shoulder upon a common journey. And when we follow this common journey laid out in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, we get to experience a power called God. And we get to experience entering the world of the Spirit, living in the sunlight of the Spirit. And there's one word for that, and that's called bliss. And that's a long way from being in the bondage of self, all the manifestations of self, along with alcohol. That's what we get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really grateful to be on that journey. Loving God separated me from alcohol June 23rd, 1988. And as I said last night, and I'll continue to say from the podium as long as God keeps me there, is that I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm not a recovering alcoholic, but a recovered alcoholic. Recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and if I did not share that, I'd be falsely humble. I share that because I am, because that's where loving God has brought me to. I share that because a newcomer who's in the grip of self, of the grip of alcoholism, can know that there's a way out of that. Our contemporary meetings will say, well, you'll always be recovering. I'm a recovering alcoholic, and bless them. But recovering is kind of like still visiting all the aspects of alcoholism and not knowing when they're going to show up. I wake up on Monday and I'm doing great, and Tuesday I wake up and it's the bottom falls out, and Wednesday's kind of in between, and Thursday I'm up and Friday I'm down, and next week I'm acting out with a spree, and the next day I have no idea what that's going to look like. I mean, that's not a way to live free in the sunlight of the Spirit. That's recovering. Oh, I cheated on my taxes, I cheated on my wife, I beat up my kids, but I didn't pick up a drink today, so I'm a winner. Right? That's recovering. Right? Recovered is not cured. And a lot of our meetings think that recovered, they hear cured. We're not cured of alcoholism, but recovered is certainly a much more awakened place to be than recovering. Because even though I still have alcoholism, I'm not suffering from all the symptoms of the illness anymore. I'm not living all over page 52 anymore. Or perhaps I'll visit page 52. Maybe on a particular day I may have trouble with personal relationships. Maybe on a particular day I may experience some fear. But I'm not living with that. That's not my state of being. And when I found out what this work does is there's this internal revolution that goes on. The spiritual experience they talk about. And who I be is made different now. And when I come out of that place of being integrated with God, that manifests in thought, word, and deed. You know, great question to ask ourselves, is my thought life and my life looking different? Is my thought life now manifested in every area of my life? And if it has, what does that look like? Am I carrying a vision of God's will into all my activities in thought, word, and deed? Or is there is a duality going on? And for many of us, we come to AA meetings, use the fellowship as God, and then she becomes God, and then money becomes God, and the car becomes God, and all the external conditions suddenly become the remedy for an internal ailment called alcoholism, and I have this huge duality going on in my life, never ever free. Thinking I'm free, telling people I'm free. You walk into an AA meeting and you got the AA game face on. They say, hey, Joe, how you doing? I'm great. Everything's great. I'm fine. Great. Everything's great. See you at the next meeting. How you doing? Great. Great. Everything's good. Let's talk about how it was on the way to meeting. No, I'm fine. I don't want to talk about that. Let's talk about you. Yeah. All right. And yet sometimes, and Maya's kind of hinted at this, where you get that person who's finally bottoms out either out there or in here in Alcoholics Anonymous and is looking for a solution and knows it's no longer the fellowship, that the fellowship is not going to keep him or her sober. The big book itself is a book. The book is not going to keep me sober, right? Another human power is not going to keep me sober. They're vehicles to take me to this power which has been keeping me sober all along. And you get that prospect, they show up and they say, okay, I'm willing to do anything. And we start giving them some work, and what gets in the way all the time is the way. What gets in the way is the way. And because they look at, well, what an order, I can't go through with it. A searching feels a moral inventory, discussing this with someone else and make amends to them. They need to make amends to me first. Right? Ego's all over that, and what gets in the way is the way. And so we need to show them that there's another way to go about this. There's a solution. And that no matter how challenging it may be looking, that my Heavenly Father, his or her Heavenly Father, will move them through that. You know, we look at the shades for the first time coming in here counting days, or maybe we're around Alcoholics Anonymous a bunch of years, 10 years or 15 years, we have 10 or 15 years worth of ego in place. And that ego and that illness looks at that and says, made a decision to turn what over to who? An inventory? Go work with others? I got other things to do. Ego's all over that. What gets in the way is the way. And very often that same prospect will say, well, wait a minute, I've been in fellowship for this time. How bad was it? Was it really that uncomfortable? And we look to go back to what wasn't working anymore. And what a sponsor needs to do is show the prospect this, that what you think is true until you find out it no longer is. You hear what I just said? What we think is true until we find out it no longer is. Example, Columbus decides to go around the world on his boat, and everyone's telling him, you can't do that, man. You go to the end, you're going to fall off. And he challenged that. Everyone was making decisions based on a flat world. People in Alcoholics Anonymous are making decisions based on an untreated mind and fellowship, never including God. And Columbus says, well, I got an idea, man. I may be able to do this, and pulls it off, and suddenly doors fly open, and now people are making decisions no longer on what was true. They have a new truth. And what a sponsor ought to do is instill a new truth into a prospect. And find out that there's another way besides fellowship. Great question I always ask someone when they come to me and the bedevilments are all over them, but they still think, they're still clinging to the idea that they can work it out. My question to them is, what was always asked to me, well, how's that going for you? How's that working? And when we get to work with people, the same way when my sponsor works with me, I encourage everyone not to answer the question right away. Listen to the question, because ego will get right in there and give you an answer it already knows. Consider a question, be with it, and answer it from a place of experience. Has not working the steps done well for you? Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. Well, let's think about that. From experience, how's that looking for you? Well, I pray and meditate. How often? Well, pretty much pretty often. Well, how often? From a place of experience, how often do we pray and meditate? Once a week. So you're not praying and meditating. Answer questions from experience. And the last thing I'll throw out to you is this. As we move through this work, acquiring knowledge will happen. Any fool can sit down and study this big book and get to a podium and share and sound really important. And just regurgitate everything they just read. That's what we did in school. Study, answer the questions, pass, and go home. So in studying this book with the teacher or sitting in one of these workshops, we will acquire some knowledge, some new knowledge. And I ask you, don't seek knowledge. That'll just happen. What I encourage you, what I urge you to do is seek experience. Seek experience, seek experience, seek experience with this power called God. Because we know you cannot understand it, but we can certainly experience it. And what we do when we sit down with a prospect is come from a place of experience. Don't need to memorize, don't need to quote. The experience will do the talking for us. My Heavenly Father will speak through me to the prospect. Seek experience. Because our book uses the word combine knowledge and experience. We will acquire knowledge. You sit down with the prospect or you sit down with your sponsor and they're starting to move you through the book. There will be some things that are going to stick. And the more we revisit this book, more will stick. We'll acquire knowledge. You can't help that. But that knowledge alone will not work. My book is really clear on that. Experience, the spiritual revolution, the transformation, the internal reorganization, whatever phrase works for you, that's it. That's when that happens. That's when we're made new. That's when we get reborn, because it's no longer talking to mind. The book is not aimed at the thinking mind. The book is aimed at spirit. For us, the main problem centers in the mind, not the body. So where's the solution? I raise my hand, so if the problem's in the mind, the solution's in the mind. And the big sign went up, wrong. The main problem for us is in the mind. The solution is in the awakening of the spirit. That's why the book is aimed at spirit. Which really makes sense why we become so uncomfortable going through the work. Because if it was aimed at mind, we just acquire some knowledge, the ego would get stroked, and we go home. But it's aimed at spirit, which is disrupting. It's uncomfortable. These drastic and revolutionary proposals that our book talks about. Some of the many lengths that a lot of us must go to. And then we realize that we get to go to those any lengths. It's aimed at spirit. In the 12 and 12, it says, who cares to admit complete defeat? Step one. When we look at some of this work, who cares to surrender to this work? Who cares to admit complete defeat in all of this work? That lack of power across the board is my dilemma. That's admitting I have no power. Complete defeat. God is everything or nothing. What's my choice to be? And I find out if God is nothing, then I certainly am also. Lack of power is my dilemma. With power, no dilemma. Book being aimed at spirit and waking up the spirit makes us uncomfortable as it ought to be. If I'm moving through this work and I'm never disturbed or agitated or doubtful or even angered by the information I'm getting, then perhaps, see, God's with us. Look at this. That means I cannot lie for the weekend. As we're moving through the work with the sponsor, we ought to be somewhat disturbed. If we're not disturbed, perhaps we're not doing the fourth step, or perhaps we're not doing this work. We're doing one of those, answer the questions and find out if you're an alcoholic. You know, they have this thing, I think it's 40 questions. Imagine being in the grip of the grace and someone says, hey, Danny, answer these 40 questions, let's find out. We'll get to like two and tell him and where to go with him and his list and go get drunk, right? We sit down with a sponsor, we can quickly diagnose ourselves. Based on my experience, some questions to consider, chances are I'm a real alcoholic. Okay, now let's move on. Now, when I sit with the prospect, I have him do some other things. Back to the book being aimed at spirit. As I'm moving through the work, from step one into step three, into step five, and so on, the further I get away as far as distance from step one, the further I get away from step one, am I getting further away from step one? What do I mean by that? If mind is doing the work for me, this is what it looks like. Show up with any lens. Myers talked about this. Okay, sponsor, I'm ready to go. I really need to do this work. And I move into two with some considerations in three, and I'm into four and five. And now I'm like done with five, and I'm ready to go into six, seven, then amends. And the mind starts to say, a lot of amends to make, really a lot of amends to make. Let's go to the meeting, talk about the amends you're going to make, and we'll make amends tomorrow. And then tomorrow shows up, and well, I don't need to go see them. They probably don't even remember me. And you know what? The more I think about it, it wasn't that bad. And little by slowly, we're not making amends. We've gotten further away from step one, further away from the lack of power, choice, and control that step one talks about me too, and the need for power. When the spirit is moving me through, the further I get away from step one down the shade, it drives me further into step one. Make sense? Then I see the real need for power. That I can't write in searching fields of moral inventory without God moving me. And the pen being a spiritual translator. I cannot go sit down and discuss step four with the fifth step with another alcoholic unless God is moving me. And there's no way I can suit up and show up and go make amends to those people that I've harmed to actually get clear of that and see that truth and the need to go right the wrongs unless God is moving me through that. So if I'm in this place of moving with spirit in thought, word, and deed, guess what? The further I move down the shade, the further I get away from step one, the more I'll be driven into step one, and that's a great thing. That'll keep me disciplined. That'll keep me right-sized. That'll keep me seeking His power with the desperation of a drowning man, whether I'm sober 2 months, 2 years, 20 years, or etc. Right. That's been my experience. I've had times where ego ran the show. Ego was writing my inventory. Ego was giving the talk. Ego was working with a prospect. And that got old quick because I was getting sick quick. And I bless my Heavenly Father. I thank my Heavenly Father, I should say, because they were short-lived. Most of this journey for me has been moved from here, from spirit out, to seek this power, to give it away in abundance, and my Heavenly Father refills me to go give away more. And I know the importance of making amends. I know the importance of writing inventory. That's why I always talk about, I get to do this. I get to write inventory. I get to pray and meditate. I get to share at a podium. I get to go to a doctor. I get to take the children to school. I get to do this stuff. Because the alternative is right now, Saturday morning, drunk in the back of some hallway in Manhattan, dying again. And that I had to do. I had to drink. No matter how much I didn't want to drink, no matter how much of a powerful desire I had within here not to drink, I was gonna drink because of the lack of power, choice, and control, no matter what was at stake. So I get to do this stuff today. This is what God allows me to do. I get to go make amends. I get to go clean up a drunk who's just gotten sick all over himself, and I get to take that drunk to a hospital. That's what I get to do today. Get to. Get driven back further into step one and the lack of power, choice, and control. That doesn't mean as we move along, a lot of opposites here, doesn't mean that I'm always going to be powerless. See, the contemporary AA will tell you, well, I'm always powerless. I'm going to be powerless. I can't help because I'm powerless. I'm sick, so I'm powerless. I think this way and I do this because I'm powerless. That's delusional. That's shortchanging the great power of a loving God. I am no longer powerless. I am just not the power. See, if you work with enough drunks, you know God has given us a lot of power to go work with another drunk. And I don't have drink signals and drink issues, and I have to watch my triggers and all this other nonsense that we'll hear in a lot of our contemporary AA meetings. I don't have drink signals, thank the good Lord, because my book says I've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. The problem has been removed. If I still have drink signals, aren't I recovering? Aren't I in alcoholism? And how? How can I make a call on make a 12-step call on a drunk who's drinking and I kick the door open and they got a pint of vodka and maybe some dry goods if I got drink signals? How can I effectively help that alcoholic? Because when I go make a call with Myers and the guy's drinking a pint of vodka, I'm going to Myers, well, that looks pretty good. Myers is now 12-stepping me and the other guy, right? See, but we can, and this is the great power God gives us, we can kick a door open, get the drunk who's drinking, I've had this happen to me many times, and get the booze and pour it down the sink, or nurse them till they get to the detox and give them a shot every so often while they're sitting in my car. I've done that. No thought of a drink, no romanticizing, no euphoric recall. God says, I need you to do work. I can't have you bothered with this. You do this work, you get free, that's a promise. Now I have work for you to go do. Go work with these drunks. Drink's not in the equation anymore. I promise you, that'll ruffle feathers at any middle-of-the-road meeting. You know how many meetings I sit in and hear Joe with 20 or 30 years on a hot summer day says, well, I went down to the local delicatessen and I saw somebody buying beer and the tall boys were sweating on the outside. Boy, oh boy, I was smacking my lips and thinking about the old days. What? Okay, time out. Where's God? So that's how you live, Joe? And then I'll tell Joe, I've gone to weddings, I've gone to parties, I've gone to delicatessens, I've walked into liquor stores to play lottery. I've done 12-step calls on people who were doing drugs in front of me and drinking at the same time, and never, ever once did my mind say, well, wait a minute, let's rethink this AA stuff for a minute, this looks awfully good. You know, I'm listening to a guy giving me his first step, talking about his drunk, his story to me, I should say. As I move him through doctor's opinion, the first 43 pages of the book, to get him to identify. Now, you know, if you're in the grip of alcoholism, some of the insane, crazy things we've done out there, so we say to ourselves, well, it doesn't sound that bad. It's kind of like fun. Or I remember when I used to do that. None of that stuff goes on. God has me as an instrument to pull that drunk out of that well to freedom. Can't be wasting time on that other stuff. That's freedom, that's bliss. We get great power in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, here, think the drink through. And Maya's talked about this, page 24. When we look at page 24 in the big book, it shoots to hell the theory of thinking the drink through. You'll hear that. Play the tape to the end. Think the drink through. Why that's a contradiction, that slogan you'll hear in AA to our first step is this. Lack of power, choice, and control in the mind before the first drink. And in the body after we pick up a drink. I have no idea what that day is going to look like when drink says, let's go. When suddenly shows up. Or I experience a strange mental blank spot, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get back to a drunk again. I can't successfully think the drink through. If I could, is it possible I'm not a real alcoholic? If I can successfully think the drink through every time, why am I sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? Yet a lot of our fellowship can think the drink through because they still have the power of choice and control. And those that have put the pluggers in the juggers and bless them, but they're not the real alcoholic, the person on page 21. And here's the problem with that. When he or she has power, choice, and control and can put the plug in a jug and they get Joe, who's a real alcoholic, who can't pull that off, he sponsors him, Joe's in a lot of trouble. Because the sponsor is telling him, just put the plug in a jug, you'll be fine. He gets drunk and the sponsor kicks back and says, well, my prospect doesn't want it enough. Well, he's here, what are you offering? He's the real alcoholic. What splits our fellowship down a whole lot with step one, two, if we go over to page 34 for a minute. Remember, lack of power, choice, control in the mind and in the body after I pick up a drink. Page 34 in the middle says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. Dr. Bob said, quit drinking for good and all. Altogether, forever. If the problem, like step 10 says, has been removed, it isn't a day at a time anymore. That's our human condition. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Here it is. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he or she has already lost the power to choose whether they will drink or not. Very simply, what my book has just told me is this. If I still have power, choice, and control, then is it possible I don't need a spiritual basis of living? That I can just show up at an AA meeting, put the plug in a jug, and play sober softball or sober bowling or go to AA dance, and that works for me. And I'm doing fine, hitting home runs every day. But if I don't have power, choice, and control, then perhaps I need a spiritual basis of life or else. And we know what the or else looks like. The or else is what brings us to our knees all the time. It's alcoholism. And so what my book does, and Maya's touched on this also, is we feel screwed. What our book does is paint us into a corner and then offers us a solution. Paints us into a corner and then offers us a solution. And what it's doing is really dismantling ego in every manifestation of self. It has to. It has to. What we often think, like I did when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, was I'm feeling, we hear newcomers say, I'm feeling empty in here, this hole in the soul. And if you're anything like me, what I quickly tried to do was acquire things to fill up. Acquire, get the relationship, get the job, get the money, smoke expensive cigars, get nice clothes, get a new car. Just get, acquire. Because when I would get those things, I'd get the new car, I'd say, wow, I feel really okay in here. I have some self-confidence, self-reliance now. I feel good. That hole in the soul is not there anymore, right? That works just a short time. Then we get the first car payment and we're sorry we even started in the first place, right? Or you get the relationship or whatever it may be. It gives us a little bit of relief for a short time. We feel kind of good about that. But never true liberation, ever. The remedy comes from God and nothing less than that great fact. And over and over and over again, my book will dismantle all the manifestations of self. Now, that emptiness that I tried to fill up by acquiring things, what was going on was I was full of all resentments and contempt and fear and resentment, worship of other things, whatever that may be, pomp, using calamity against God. Chapter 2 of Gnostics talks about that. So really, I was so full of things that were no longer working. That's why I felt empty. And acquiring stuff from the external world to fill up some more does not work. That's my experience and countless others, and I will come at you this weekend with experience. What does work is the complete opposite, the removal of all of that. That's the drastic and revolutionary proposals our book talks about. The removal of all of that, the removal of self, the dismantling of egos, the dismantling of all the things that we think are God. We find out aren't God, and that way we find out what God possibly is for us. The work removes. It's by subtraction, never addition, that we get to experience this power called God. So you'll hear a sponsor tell the prospect, you know, the middle of the road contemporary AA relationship goes like this. Okay, Joe, call me every day. And Joe says, I got all my prospects. They work a great program. They call me every day. No, they're annoying is what they are. Or the sponsor doesn't have a life. The dependence must be upon God, not the sponsor or any other human power. Maya's talked about this. One of the greatest things my current sponsor has allowed me to do was get free of him. One of the first things he told me was, my job is to get you as independent of me as quick as possible and dependent upon God. And I heard, I don't like you, Peter, so I got to get rid of you. But I see the great value in that. So we don't need the prospect to call us every single day. We need to get them to experience God. And we need to get them to get through this work to dismantle self. It's by removal, not addition. And you know what happens to us? What the work lets us see. I sat with someone and they taught me a great lesson. What the work allows us to see is this. We go home. When we showed up, we were spiritually perfect. Coming from a Heavenly Father, we were put here to walk a journey, and over time, we've acquired things that no longer work. Belief systems, contempt, prejudice, pride, ego, you name it, we've been filled up with it. And in the removal of that, the less self, the more God, we get filled with the Spirit of God. We're no longer drinking, by the way. In fact, our book says, we cease fighting anything or anyone. Oh, even alcohol. And we get free, and we, in a sense, go home. Everything we need to walk through this journey until we go home to God is given to us. We got all we need. We've acquired things that have gotten in the way of that. And what the work does is take a sledgehammer to self, to ego, to pride, and removes that. And in that removal, which is incredibly uncomfortable, we get free. And to get there, there's some considerations our book asks us. In chapter 2 Gnostics, they ask us a very simple question. And really, the answer is obvious, but our book is even being kind. Is God everything or nothing? What's our choice to be? Like God, when he inspired this book, said, all right, how am I going to do this? I got alcoholics. We'll ask them what's their choice to be. We'll stroke the ego a little bit here. Is there really a choice? Is God everything or nothing? Based on circumstances, which make me willing to do this work, based on my first step experience, which brings me to a place of I'll do anything, sponsor, what choice do I really have? Is God everything or nothing? It really comes down to, is God going to be everything or am I going to continue to drink and die? There are no alternatives. It's drink to the bitter end or accept spiritual help. That's when our book, I believe, just nails it. Accept spiritual help or go on to the bitter end. And we all have our bitter end. We know what that looks like. Last night I talked about how many of us will bristle with antagonism and experience some tension and resistance when we find out, hey, the solution in step two is God. It's appointed to the solution. Oh, wait, what does that mean? Here comes the mind. Here comes the ego. We're going to get spiritual and religious now, so maybe we should find a new sponsor. This sounds a little too drastic for me. In chapter to agnostics, we go over to page, I think it's 46. Yeah. Page 46, with step two. I always refer to this little piece because I had a gentleman sitting at my house one time, street guy, a tough guy, big strappy guy, wanted to do this work until we got to step two. And step two talks about being brought to this place, that this power greater than me was going to restore me to wholeness of mind, sanity, where I'm no longer thinking about a drink anymore. I'm going to get to this place of experience wholeness of mind through the spiritual experience and no longer thinking about drinking. That if I was going to be restored to sanity, it must mean I'm insane somewhere. For us, it's thinking we can repeat the same thing over and over and expect different results. We have a mind that'll take us back to that which is killing us. And this guy was all on board until he came to chapter to agnostics and he talked about God. And then I read to him this. It says, in second paragraph, it says, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than myself, I commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. My question to him was, are you willing to grow along spiritual lines, yes or no? Are you willing to work with a power greater than yourself, yes or no? And based on his first step, he was certainly willing. But he knew what he was in for. And then I read to him this, much to our relief, and I told him, much to your relief, you don't need to consider anyone else's conception of God. Look what our book does. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. And for me, I used group of junks for good orderly direction at the very beginning. I felt power in the unity of this fellowship. It was a start. And the reason why it worked, because I was willing to even go past there. I would come to an AA meeting and feel safety here. Was that going to be the beginning and end of it all? No. But it worked for a while. Group of junks for good orderly direction. That was my own conception, no matter how inadequate it was. It says, as soon as I admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, another way of saying God, a spirit of the universe, another way of saying God, underlying the totality of things, I began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided I took other simple steps. Great promise. We found that God does not make too hard terms to those who seek him. Am I willing to seek this power called God? To us, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open to all. And I read this to this guy, and he began to weep. Because it was the first time in his life he wasn't being shown religious dogma, religious beliefs. He was given a spiritual approach which was aimed at spirit. And it said that God doesn't make too hard terms if you're willing to seek him. It's inclusive, not exclusive. God's not concerned, well, you did this and you did that, so you can't come to me. God's saying, you're my children, come to me. I'm waiting. And I broke this little piece down to this guy. He began to weep and he says, I never thought I had a shot with this power called God based on what brought me in here. And I know what brought him in here besides the alcoholism. He was full of shame and guilt about some ugly behavior. And it was the first time in his life the light went on because he felt hope that perhaps I can experience God and get free. Because most of his trouble was when he was under the influence. And when he wasn't drinking, the only he can do is thinking about drinking and plan to drink and rob to drink and get money to drink and so on and so forth. Suddenly, this guy felt free. On that, and I always like to talk about this gentleman, this guy rocketed, didn't move, rocketed through the work. That's what our book offers us. But what we want to do in a lot of our A meetings is let's put that aside and just tell the newcomer, hey, just don't drink and go to meetings and hang in there. You know, make 90 meetings in 90 days. Here's it. Let me challenge 90 meetings for 90 days for a minute. Our book says, we're going to read about this and how it works. We had to quit playing God. It didn't work. When I tell a newcomer who's coming in here for the first time or the 10th time, but a newcomer, and they're in that place of obsession, right? They're going out over everything. In fact, they're probably going to go get drunk right after the meeting. And we kick back and tell them, make 90 meetings in 90 days. Are we not playing God with that simple statement? Like, we know they're going to make 90 meetings in 90 days and not pick up. Maybe that person who's offering that doesn't really know what alcoholism is. That if that guy or woman gets home tonight without a drink, there's a miracle in itself. That there's a good possibility that after this meeting, we're probably going to lose them. Yet we kick back and say, make 90 meetings in 90 days. If they don't die or get drunk when they show up to 90 meetings in 90 days, then what are you going to offer them then? Another 90? Because I've heard that. Now make another 90. When does 90 meetings in 90 days replace the power and glory of God? We can say never, but it has in a lot of our AA halls. You know, the value of sponsorship, the value of seeing a newcomer and letting them know you have a solution for them, that they never have to pick up a drink again. You have something from your experience that you've gotten from another teacher, another sponsor, and you're willing to offer that to them. But I don't ever go up to a prospect and say, you need a sponsor? I'm him. I won't do that. You know why? I need spiritual consent from him first. When he says, can you sponsor me? Then he's on board. And then we'll begin this work. Because what sponsorship? Our book says we can't transmit something we haven't got. And guess what? We can what we do. And sometimes that's bad information and untreated alcoholism. This is a huge responsibility God has given us. And great power to go work with others. How's that looking? What am I passing on? Because if you get the arrogant, selfish, self-seeking, self-centered sponsor, trust me, his prospects will resemble that. Or her prospects will resemble that. If you get the sponsor who don't drink and go to meetings, guess what? His prospects or her prospects will resemble that. It's a huge responsibility here. So the need for me, who sponsors many, to continue to work with my sponsor and revisit the first 9 proposals. So is God going to be everything or nothing? I got real clear that God's going to be everything. God was here before my heart took its first beat, be there long after it takes its last beat. God is everything. And in the nothingness, there is God anyway, the everything of God. There's no beginning and ending point with this power called God. It just is. Just is. And that has brought me to living the way I live today, a life of invitation and surrendering to what is. Okay. So we look at step 2 and we have a solution that's offered to us, and our book is real clear. Your own conception, no matter how inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach. Are you willing, yes or no? And we move into step 3. We go to page 58 for a minute. So we see the lack of power I have in the first 43 pages in step 1, and we're offered a solution in step 2. And I'm willing to do this. I'm willing to seek this power that's going to restore me to sanity. I'm willing to live along God's terms and not mine, whatever that looks like. And we sit down with a sponsor and we take a look at how it works, which is going to bring us into step 3 and 4. And it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. Fail at what? Well, we know sobriety, but how about fail at God consciousness who's thoroughly followed our path? What we're talking about here is God consciousness. Awake to this power called God, right? Those who do not recover are people cannot or will not completely give themselves to a simple program. Usually men and women are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They're such an unfortunate, they're not at fault, they seem to have been born that way. They're naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. It's a manner of living. It's now who we be. It isn't this occasional thing, well, today I'll be rigorously honest because AAs are around me, so I'm going to show everyone how spiritual I am. You know. You're at an AA meeting, someone drops a $10 bill and you say, hey, you dropped $10, everyone's watching, so I'm going to be rigorously honest, right? Then you're out on the street and someone drops their wallet, you go, yes. Too many of you people identified with that. That's scary. I was hoping someone would go, not me. So we developed this manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Okay. It says, there are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. What's my grave emotional and mental disorder? When I would read that for the longest time, and back home we read How It Works, like at every meeting, How It Works gets read, at least this portion of it, right? And I would think people with grave emotional and mental disorders were people who had some other issues, some other challenges. And that didn't apply to me. And then I sat with my sponsor and he asked me that question, what's your grave emotional mental disorder? And I didn't have an answer for him. He says that you have a mind, an alcoholic mind, that'll take you back to that which is killing you. And it may not be booze on the first call. It may be the sprees that I was talking about last night. The sex spree, the food spree, the money spree, etc. The sprees. Because I'm starting to feel so much discomfort in here, I need to seek comfort out there. And I go to my external world to seek comfort. What I'm doing in reality is just running away from the discomfort. Right? Not getting any comfort. That's my grave emotional and mental disorder. And eventually a drink will show up and I have a mind that will take me back to that which is killing me. Grave emotional and mental disorder. Running out there to fill up, running out there to fill up, running out there to feel good, to feel good, to feel good. And I'm starting to worship my emotions and external conditions rather than this power. And those attachments need to be cut. That's bondage. Because it gives me a little bit of pleasure when I'm spending money, a little bit of pleasure whatever I'm doing. And then back into pain. I did it again. I can't believe I did it. Oh my God, if anyone finds out, I'm feeling uncomfortable, so I need to seek comfort. Where do I go? Right back out there again. And it gets worse and worse and worse. And those strings of attachments need to be cut if I'm ever going to get free. What this work will do, because it's moving in an experience with God, will cut all of that away from me. It says we have the capacity to be honest. About 4 ounces of soda in here, right? Has the capacity to be filled. And what we tend to do is what I was alluding to earlier is just keep pouring stuff in there. Or if we leave it alone, it becomes old and murky and sour. That's exactly what's going on with us. But we have the capacity, this vehicle we walk around with, the spirit, the soul that we walk around, to be filled with the Spirit of God. And what needs to be done is everything needs to be emptied out. Because we have the capacity to have the Spirit of God flow into us and out to others. Into us and out to others. We can be filled with the Spirit of God. That's what my book is telling me here. I have the capacity to be filled here. And how do I get filled up? By emptying out. It says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, running life on self-will, what happened to spiritual experience, and what we are like now. Living in the sunlight of the Spirit. Am I willing to go to any lengths to get it? The ABCs appear on page 60. Am I real clear that drunk or sober, I'm an alcoholic and can't manage my own life? Experientially, let me answer that question. Drunk or sober, can I manage my own life? Well, drunk I can't manage my life, but sober I can manage my life. Look how good everything looks. I just came back from a holiday. I have a new house. I have a new relationship and a pocket full of money. I can manage my own life. Right? But then get one of those things removed from that equation, and we're down on our knees. Sponsor, come help me. She left. She don't love me anymore. My boss hates me. I can't make the car payment. That drunk or sober, probably no human power could have relieved their alcoholism. I experimented with the human power, by the way, thinking that she was going to get me sober. And then the two of us got drunk. Right? No human power could relieve me of alcoholism. And that God could and would if he was sought. And with experience, that idea becomes realized, and it's God can, has, and will if I continue to seek him. Am I willing to seek this power called God? Now, many times in AA meetings, we'll hear these long, windy, wordy discussions about how to turn it over. And what's worse is we'll tell a newcomer who's coming in here, living all over page 52, in the grips of alcoholism, and we say, hey, Joe, turn it over. And when they told me that, I want to turn the podium over. What does that mean, turn it over? Give me instructions. Give me directions on how to turn it over. A book uses the phrase middle-of-the-road solution. And I always wonder, well, what does that mean? Very simply, any instruction that don't tell you how to have a spiritual experience is a middle-of-the-road solution. So when Joe, with his 40 years, says, hey, turn it over. Let go and let God. Don't forget about acceptance. Turn him and the table over. Don't do that. Don't do that. Because there's no instructions on how to do that stuff. Halt. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Watch out for Halt. Like Halt is lurking somewhere down the block. Myers, when we get to the hotel, look out for Halt. It may be there. You know. Halt. Right? That's a solution to alcoholism. Right? They're nice little slogans, but without instructions on how to experience these things or not to experience these things, what does it mean? It's just words that look good on a wall. Halt. By the way, the thing about halt, who really wants to be hungry? Who feels like being angry? Who wants to be lonely? Who cares to be tired? Myers and I had a long trip. We're both kind of tired. I wish I wasn't, but we're tired. Who likes to be tired? No one. No one in their right mind wants to experience halt. But we have this private little thing, watch out for halt. And I'll tell you something else about halt. If when you read Fred's story in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, they say, watch out for halt. Don't experience halt. It's a trigger for a drink. Fred wasn't hungry. Fred wasn't angry. Nor was he lonely or tired. And guess what happened to Fred? Got loaded. So much for halt. How about let's put halt over there. Halt from saying halt and let's talk about God. So we have these long discussions about turning it over. And my book says, being convinced of what? Of the ABCs. Am I convinced of that? We are at step three, which is that we decide to turn our will, our thinking, and my actions over to this power called God, as we currently understand them. Then it says this, what do we mean by that and what do we do? So we can avoid all those long discussions on turning it over, because my book says, what do we mean by that and what do we do? This is how we're going to do it. And they go on to explain what they mean by turning it over and how to turn it over. It says the first requirement. Now, there's a requirement here. One of the requirements is self-searching, leveling up of our pride to confession of shortcomings, which this process requires for its successful consummation. There's another requirement here. See, our fellowship says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. So, come on in. I have a desire to stop drinking. Take a seat. Can't throw you out. But in order to recover from alcoholism, by what the book's talking about, there's some requirements. And in step three, it says, the first requirement that I'm convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Am I convinced of that? And guess what? If I've had an experience moving through the first proposal, I probably will be convinced that based on my track it, from a place of experience, me running the show only gets me sicker, harms others, and I get loaded. So yeah, I'm convinced of that. It says, even though my motives are good, and I'll say this about motives. An alcoholic with a motive ought to be considered armed and dangerous. Right? Two AA guys are talking. Who's that new girl? I don't know, never saw her before. I think she's got about 10 days. Let me see if she needs a sponsor. I'll help her. You know how that one goes, right? A self-seeker, even when we make out we're being kind. Like, hey, have you heard from Bill? What I'm looking to do is, I don't care about Bill. I just want to get into some gossip and drama. So he'll say, yeah, I heard from last week. He's drunk. Oh, really? He's drinking? Now we got a little thing going on. But I'm coming at you like, I'm really care and concerning about Bill. No, I'm not. A self-seeking woman trying to be kind. Hey, I love that shirt you're wearing. You're really a good member of AA. You're a great guy. And next thing comes out of my mouth, can you loan me $20? Self-seeking. But it's disguised with, I'm just a great guy to you. You're my best friend in the whole world. Tell her, I can sponsor you. I can help you. How's that looking? Page 62. Let's watch the shift that goes on in, from 62 to 63, and we'll get into our third step. It says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. The root of our troubles. Where are roots on a tree? Under the ground. Right? Most trees or flowers, the roots are under the ground. They're hidden. That's just like alcoholism. We'll walk into a meeting and we'll say, how are you doing? And Joe says, I'm great. I'm fine. Everything looks good. Get all dressed up. Look real good. Make sure everything's all in order to walk into that meeting. Excuse me. Because the inside, God forbid it if it resembled the outside, because the inside were falling apart and the outside's got to have this facade going on. Right? Alcoholism hides out. Doesn't let anyone see it until it's so full-blown that someone walks in the door, you know they're in trouble. But it'll hide out. And it'll convince the alcoholic and where it lies that he or she's okay. The ego will endorse behavior that doesn't resemble someone on a spiritual path. It has to because it needs to breathe. Hey, it's okay to cheat on your taxes. It's okay to lie. It's okay to cheat and steal. You know what you need to do, and it's you who's doing it. Those other people have to watch out for that. See, that's how ego chokes me right back to a drunk. It's hidden. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. I'm driven, not moved by God, but driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And what do? I hurt you. I step on the toes of my fellows, and you retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that sometime in the past I made decisions based on self which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So I step on the toes of my fellows. There's my first column. They retaliate. There's my self, second column. I make a decision based on self. There's columns 3 and 4. So Danny's not talking to me anymore. And I'm saying, well, can you imagine this guy, Danny? He doesn't talk to me. Who does he think he is? And then I write inventory and I find out I've been gossiping about Danny for the last 6 months, saying a lot of unkind things, but my ego says it's okay to do. Danny gets wind of it and Danny wants nothing to do with me. But I'm angry with him. You see how delusional it is and how alcoholism will continue to endorse that? Then I take stock and I say, oh my God. Look at my behavior towards him. And I show up to step 9, I knock on Danny's door, and I need to make amends to him and to everyone else I've been gossiping about with him. And suddenly, I'm getting awfully free. Prior to that, my ego doesn't even allow me to see how much bondage I'm in. I just know I'm in pain. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. My book just told me that the unmanageability is an internal condition, not an external one. The perceptions of situations are what cause me pain and suffering. Rarely the reality of it. The perceptions, my internal unmanageability is the problem. And we're extreme examples of self will run riot, even though I don't think so. Extreme examples. And I need to be rid of this, and God is going to make this possible. Am I willing to submit to this? Bottom of page 62, and here's our third step. It says, this is the how and why of it. First, I had to quit playing God. Why? It didn't work. Next, I decide hereafter in this drama of life, God's going to be the director. He's the principal. We're his agents. We represent God. He's the father. We're his children. A father loves his children unconditionally. And when I took this position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. Being all-powerful, God provided me what I needed if I kept close to him and performed his work well. It says this, established on this footing, I became less and less interested in me, my little plans and designs, and more interested in what I can contribute to life. There's a shift. Look at page 62. Look at what our third step's talking about. It says we are reborn. And then we come to our third step. And the wording is optional. What's my intent entering this third step? Do I really want to turn this over to God? If someone never saw this third step before, but was willing to turn everything over to God, that will do. God doesn't make hard turns, but our book gives us a beautiful prayer. A great assignment that was given to me and I give to others is write out this third step prayer word for word. Right? And then next to that, write out your interpretation of the third step prayer, word for word. What is this prayer saying to you? What does it mean to you? then it suddenly becomes your prayer. And then we do the third step prayer, and we don't hang around. It says next, we launch on a course of vigorous action, and we move steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. I have a few minutes here, and we'll just touch on 4. How do I do a third step after the prayer? How do I work step 3? By putting pen to paper, move 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. What step 4 will allow us to do is, for the first time, take stock of self and force me not to blame you for my troubles. I'm holding up a mirror to me for the very first time in my life, and that's a drastic and revolutionary proposal. I'm looking at a resentment inventory, a fear inventory, a sex inventory, 4-column inventory that no longer points the finger at you but back to me and taking a look at me. What an order. I can't go through with it. Fourth step allows me to see how I've been playing God in every area of my life by making demands upon people that were unrealistic, that you need to do this for me in order to make me feel good. It allowed me to see how many times I showed up to a relationship secretly, inwardly demanding that you give me what I need because I don't feel good about me. You give me what I need, and when you didn't, I became incredibly angry with you. And it would be the silent scorn or the outward words and the verbal abuse because you're not giving me what I want because I was so full of fear, so full of old belief systems. It allowed me to see very often when I was moving through fourth step inventory that the two people I was really angry with was not you or you or you, because each time I wrote inventory, those people keep changing and so do the causes. But I was really just angry with God because he didn't do what I wanted, and angry with me because I didn't live up to these great expectations that I had. And I was just fueled and driven by fear. Never going to make it, never going to do it, and God ain't listening. I'm truly all alone. So I look at this resentment inventory, and I will tell you my experience of following directions and not. Sit down and write inventory for the first time, my first fourth step inventory. I came from a place of living in the back of a hallway with cockroaches and rats and just a horrible time, to now I'm writing an inventory in this nice little apartment. And I'm a member of AA and I'm showering regularly. I have clean clothes on, living as I from the past where I was living in a hallway, right? And I go to sit down and write inventory. And the first thing that crosses my mind is, I need to make a lot of coffee because it's going to be a long night, and people in AA drink coffee, so I'll make some coffee, right? My first coffee pot, so I put on a pot of coffee, and I sit down to write inventory, and I look at the place and say, well, the rug needs to be vacuumed. It's a little dirty. And I was living in the back of a hallway. Bathing was the last thing on my mind. I would watch the rats go in and out of the, you know, need to vacuum the rug. Then I'll write inventory, right? And I would do that, and then I would say, well, I'm hungry, so let me eat, have coffee. Well, now I need to digest my food. So I'll watch a little TV, and the next day shows up. Or I would sit down to write, and I would do this. Well, my sponsor doesn't need to know about that. I'm not really resentful with Joe. Sex inventory, no one's getting, so let's turn the page. Right? And I start to get sick, and dis-ease, and discomfort, and it was on me again. Now, my very first sponsor, I'll clean up the language, but when I went to him with this, he said to me, what about turning to God? God's the power, not you. And he gave me a lot of earthy things that made me get some truth about this, that I agreed that I was going to turn everything over to God, and my lack of power. But he said it with, you guys remember a show called Taxi on TV? Remember the character played by, remember the character Louis De Palma, the short, heavyset guy? Remember how rough he was? Well, he looked like Cinderella next to my first sponsor. And my sponsor, he was a method to his madness. He would just rip right through. And he told me, I am not, for 1 minute, and Maya's talked about this beautifully, like, I'm not going to get into your drama. I'm here to save your life. God is made me your appointed teacher. I'm going to get you well. My sponsor told me, I am not going to allow any of your illness to interfere in my conversation with you, and I will cut to the chase any which way I can, and if it's too hard for you, find someone else. What happened to let go and let God? You know. But I felt safety in that, because he was sure. And that's what I needed at the beginning. And so what I had to do To get past my illness, first time writing inventory, I wrote on the top of the page, "Thank you, God, for the power to be searching, fearless, and moral." Go to this power to do that. And then I would pray and get still. And I would create my first column, my resentment list. And I went back through my lives. My book says on page 65, we went back through our lives before the first drink. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. So I went back through my life. So I went back as far as I can remember. This is the first time through. My current inventories are current inventories. And I went back to mom and dad and so on and so forth. See, my book says on page 64, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. So we're back to that root underneath, the stem, the resentments, this tree of illness. Bill says, remove these defects, root and branch. We have this tree of illness that needs to go away. Resentments are not only fatal to me as the alcoholic, they're fatal to anyone I come in contact with. And what we're about to do is be rid of them completely. And I need to go to God first for the power to do this, to be searching, fearless, and moral. And guess what? After I prayed and got still and asked God for this power to do this, the pen now becomes a spiritual translator and names start showing up. And I didn't figure out, well, what about this name? Where's this coming from? How come I have that name? I just wrote, first time through the work, just wrote names. When I got to the second column, explained to me, why am I angry with the person in column one? My cause. And I didn't write a life story. Resentment Joe, he did this. Well, resentment mom, she was an alcoholic. Resentment mom took her life. Resentment mom lied to me. Resentment mom, she died. So you get the point. It wasn't, well, my mom was a good woman. She grew up in South Brooklyn. And one day, to the point. If we look at the example, he says, Mr. Brown, his attention to my wife, period. And only God's going to make me able to be that specific, clear-cut, and precise with this stuff. And I write my causes. I come to the third column. They talk about these areas. Pride, person, relationship, self-esteem, security, ambition, pocketbook, and sex relations. And what I was able to do is get to understand what they were talking about. Pride, how I think others value me. How I think your opinion of me is. And I got to write pride. No one should see me this way. No one should know that mom's an alcoholic. No one should know I have an alcoholic mom. No one should see me picking up my mom in the morning on the front steps. Right? My personal relationships, what I think the relationship should look like. My self-esteem, how I value me. I'm a step worker, I'm a spiritual person, I'm a caring person. We usually see ourselves that way. If I see myself that way, then how could you possibly be angry with me? Or how can you behave the way you have been towards me? Don't you know how great I am? The other part of self-esteem is I'm a loser, you should step all over me. Usually resentments come from the former, not the latter. Pocketbook is money, security, emotional security, what I need to be okay. I need you to do certain things so I feel okay. I need you to behave a certain way, say certain things, act a certain way, talk a certain way, dress a certain way so I can be okay. Total attachment to external conditions and people. I need your opinion of me to be, well, you honor me. That's what it comes down to. You worship me. Nothing less than that. For me to be okay. My ambition, what I want, how's that hurt, interfere, or threaten? What's my goal? What do I want? And sex relations, not only sex, but my ideas of a man, how a man ought to be, and the roles of a woman. What does that look like? I realized after writing inventory why I was having such trouble with personal relationships with women. Real men do this. Women do that. Well, maybe not. I had a great assignment that was given to me. Write out my idea of what a real man is. And the first printing went like this. Real men have lots of money, don't ask questions, fight to settle things. Real men don't cry. Real men are a combination of John Wayne and my dad. Throw a punch, ask questions later, never fear the police. All this rough, tough stuff. Right? Real men work. And then I had to rewrite that again. Because my consideration was this. Does the man who's meek, who can't fight, less than a man? The man who doesn't have money, who's perhaps poor, less than a man? Is the man who's out of work less than a man? Is a man who cries less than a man? Now you know why I was having so much trouble with relationships. Because I would look at that, and I've been all of those things as less than a man. And then I realized there is no definition. As a child of God, all I need to do is seek this power and carry the vision of His will into all my activities. I'm done. God will put me on the path He needs to put me in, how to touch others. And suddenly my world became awfully light and free. Okay, page 66. It says, we turn back to the list because it held the key to the future. We're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see how the world and its people really dominated me. I'm prepared to look at my life from an entirely different angle. If I step down there for a moment, the room has one particular view. But from up here, I get a completely different angle, a view of the room. When we're writing inventory, we get to experience a shift in perceptions in looking at our life. And I get to see the harms caused to others and how the resentments and fear was the evil and corroding threat. Come to my fourth column, ask me some simple questions. Where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And sometimes my third column will be a precursor to fear inventory when I get to write that out. Where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I self-seeking? Where was I frightened? See, even though other people may have done wrong things to me, and our book talks about that, it says, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. So perhaps some people were at fault. Maybe some people did some bad things to us growing up or currently. My book says we had to disregard that entirely. Where was I at fault? Am I still hating someone for something they did to me 20 years ago? I need to be rid of that. So my book is real clear. I had to disregard what they did entirely, even though my mind wants to hold on to that, and take my inventory, and I write down where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. And when I'm done with the resentment inventory, there's some questions they give us for sex inventory. And some things about fear inventory. You know, how did I set the ball rolling? Because fear comes from within me. Fear doesn't come from God. And the thing about fear, it says we had to, how did we set the ball rolling? Didn't self-reliance fail us? Isn't fear another manifestation of self? And isn't God more powerful than self? So we can certainly outgrow fear. And I'll close with this because we're just about at lunchtime. How many of us, it's a question, show of hands, how many of us have fear of drinking? Show of hands. Now the logical answer would be, yeah, I'll put my hand up too, I have fear of drinking. But my book says we outgrow fear. Is it possible that I have fear of drinking because somewhere I think I have something to do with keeping me sober, separated for good and all? If God is keeping me sober for good and all, why do I have fear of drinking if I'm doing this work and seeking this power? God removes the problem, not me. Now, up front, say, well, yeah, I don't want to go back to that lifestyle anymore. I get that. But am I walking around in fear of drinking again? Because that implies there's some self-reliance in there somewhere. But if God has completely removed that from me and restored me to sanity, and I know God's in charge of that deal, I don't need to fear picking up a drink again because I'm in an experience with Him. The problem's been removed. If the problem's been removed, how could I fear it? It's no longer part of my life. And on that, we'll go to lunch. Thanks.